So I think with the effects of the fact value distinction, I mean, particularly as it's been formulated since the 18th century, but as I say before that, you know, very implicitly around, is the dualism of absolutism versus relativism. So, I mean, relativism has developed from that distinction being made. But you know, there's an alternative response to it, which is absolutism. So either you try and make your values into facts in some way. So you say, you know, it's true that we should act in this way or that way. Or, you know, God gives us true commands or something of this kind. Yeah, that's the sort of absolutist response, which implicitly accepts the fact value distinction. It's just trying to make sure that you're on the recognisably strong side of it, you know, yeah. Turning your values into facts. And then it's just other people's values or the wrong values which are on the wrong side of the fence, which are excluded by that.
Could you just define what a fact is?
A fact, well, it's a claim about something being the case.
So implicit in that, a fact is either true or false then? So
it's in the representationalist setup, yes.
And a value?
Well, there are various accounts of value in philosophy. The most basic one, I think, is and the one I tend to use, is that it's some kind of motivating view of something or view of a situation, which so it includes desires, or it may include one thing being judged as better than another in some respect.
Okay.
So fact is almost like a piece of knowledge, and knowledge is justified true belief.
Yeah.
Okay,
so yeah, that's where the fact value distinction may lead to absolutism, if you try to dodge it by turning your values into facts, effectively. But of course, the alternative is to recognise that your values are not facts, but you see them as being on the wrong side of the fence. So that means that they're just subjective, or they're just irrational, or, you know, you just happen to have those values. Maybe because you chose them in a random sort of way, or maybe because you were brought up that way. But there's no particular reason why you should have been brought up that way, as it were. There's no further justification for having been brought up that way. So that's what leads to relativism. But if you don't accept that distinction in the first place, there's no reason why you should be stuck in either of the in that dualism. So, you know, just coming back to the fact that all facts include values and all values include facts in practice. So the way those two positions appear, well, absolutism, we've talked a bit already about appeals to God and traditional religious ethics, but also in Kantian ethics and utilitarianism. So Kantian ethics is basically a philosophical attempt to base the justification of what's good or right on rational consistency. You know, so if you're following a principle which can be made completely rational without contradiction. For example, Kant argues that it's wrong to lie, because you couldn't apply a principle that it's okay to lie without making an exception for yourself. You know, so you couldn't, for example, be happy with a world where other people lied. So you can consistently apply the permission you're giving yourself to lie by following such a principle. Or to take another example, if you drop litter, but you wouldn't be happy for other people to drop litter, especially in your garden, you know, that's like a rational inconsistency, which you know, would fall foul of the kind of principles that, you know, that Kant is offering. You know, you couldn't follow a consistent principle that it's okay to drop litter if you disapprove of other people dropping litter.
Because it says, act that your principle of action might safely be made a law for the whole world.
Yeah, that's a kind of paraphrase of it, yeah.
One of the problems with that is that, I can see is the... It's a very individual, personal assessment, even though it's universal. So is this problem that lies with the golden rule, isn't it? It's like, do as you would be done by, but you can't assume necessarily that other people want to be done to the way you wish to be done to.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the truth thing is a good one. And some people would choose, you know, lying. I know some people that would actually say, actually, I'd sooner just lie to me. I don't, you know, what I don't know isn't going to upset me, so keep it to yourself.
And sometimes it is morally appropriate to lie, you know. Classic examples, if you were in the Second World War, you were harbouring a Jewish family, and the Nazis came to the door. But even in that situation, Kant said he would tell, he'd use a different example with a murderer come to the door to murder your daughter, and he'd tell the person where your daughter was.
So it always seems to come back down to conditions, doesn't it?
But I mean, Kant is a big problem with Kant's principles here is he's relying on representationalism. Yeah, so you've got a principle, and that principle expresses a rational truth, not a divine truth necessarily, but a rational truth, which is always going to be universally the case, which only makes sense if you believe what it means is something out there, which is always the case. And of course, the practical effect of that, is it is very inflexible.
Yeah, but it's a great rule of thumb.
Yeah, it can be helpful as a rule of thumb.
As a
guide.
I think the best paraphrase for it is something like, what if everyone else did that?
Yeah. So both Kantian ethics in its the form that Kant gave it, it's pretty absolutist.
Yeah.
Even though, you know, it doesn't appeal to God, but it appeals instead to the absolute value of reason, really, as consistent reason, in verbal formulations, in principles. Utilitarianism, similarly, so utilitarianism tries to come up with a universal ethics by saying we should act so as to bring about the best consequences, and the best consequences are ones that maximise pleasure for everybody affected and minimise pain. Again, it's the belief that we should focus on pleasure and pain, particularly as part of the structure there, but only focus on the consequences of our actions, which, you know, has contributed to quite a lot of practical, you know, advances in ethics. I'd certainly concede that utilitarianism used by governments often leads to better kinds of interventions than those based on divine ethics, for example, where people start thinking about consequences. This is quite often helpful, but the big hole in it is people have to make those judgments about what the consequences of those actions are going to be. They also have to make the choice about what the most desirable sorts of consequences are, and those people make mistakes. So it's the fallibility, it's the recognition of the fallibility of our judgments, which gets in the way of utilitarianism in practice.
Iraq,
yes. It's a good example of that, yes. Yes, it's amazing what you can evoke with one word, isn't it?
Yes.
It can be mega projects. I mean, another one that springs to mind is the Three Gorges Dam. Or it can be everyday things, you know, make a misjudgment about what sort of present you think Fred might like, but perhaps you haven't really taken into account Fred's character. You've just, you know, based it on a stereotype or something like this, and made the wrong judgment. Okay, so although there are ways forward, there's an attempt to address conditions in both Kantian ethics and utilitarianism, an attempt to move forward from just appealing to God They're both absolutists still in the sense that they think they've got a specific idea of what's right, and they turn that into a general principle which they impose on the situation regardless of whether the general principle always works. Yeah, so they're implicitly assuming that it does always work. And the proposed approach is relativism, where moral claims are only justified by either social convention or individual choice, and the key thing there is that there is seen as being no objective standard beyond that. So if it's cultural issues are one obvious example of this. So supposing there's a question about whether to provide halal meat for Muslims or something of this kind. If you could draw the conclusion just that, well, that's okay for them, so it's right for them, but it's not right for me. Yeah, that's where the implicit relativism starts. I mean, you could have a broader conclusion, a broader principle, which justifies that approach. It's where you simply assume that there are different sets of values applying in different situations that you get relativism. But if you're supposing you might have a principle of recognition of rights, for example, which might go beyond relativism. You know, so you might say, well, it's better for people to make their own choices because if you interfered, that would be counterproductive. That would be addressing conditions in a particular way. But if you simply assume there is no better choice, that's the sort of relativist assumption. And if with something like halal meat, say, we don't dare to criticise the way in which halal meat is produced, saying like the bleeding of an animal before it expires, that's the obvious issues, I think, with that. but at the same time, there's going to be a balance of consequences you've got to take into account if you choose to criticise it or to attempt to change that situation. And so you'll be psychologically realistic about the way in which Muslims regard those practices.
Another thing is, when you started talking about absolutism, and I was like, good, that's clear, I'm definitely not into that. I'm like, I obviously don't believe in God's laws, but, you know, when that was explained, the more it was explained, the more I was like, okay, I can make my position absolute on how I feel about that. But then the description of that, I had an idea in my mind of what relativism was, as in the opposite of absolutism, from the description of absolutism. And when you described the example, that wasn't how I imagined it at all. So if absolutism is there's rule that's set, then for me relativism is you just change the rules depending on the circumstances, which is different to saying they have those rules that are different to my rules. Because I think if there's a lot of cruelty involved in halal meat, then I think that is immoral. But that conflicts with it, you know, that, well, not conflicts with, but that's, you know, up against another moral I have, which is to not tell everyone else what to do. So yes, I wouldn't, but that doesn't, in my view, make it any less immoral. It just means that I have different things going on.
So you've got a practical rule there which might restrain you from being critical in that circumstance.
Yeah.
You're still making a moral judgment, yes, which you can justify.
Exactly.
And I think that's fair enough. But just in terms of relativism and changing rules according to circumstances, I think there's an important distinction to be made there between, a utilitarian approach, for example, does allow you to use different rules in different circumstances because you calculate according to the consequences of your actions. And that's not relativist. Relativism is where there were completely different standards,
yes,
applying in different circumstances.
Yeah. When you said, I did suspect that what I'd assumed was relative, that just wasn't, then no, I don't like either of them. Controversial out there. If it's just We're making, like, we know this, but we're making judgments about these things all the time and what's right or better or worse. Because if it's just engaging with conditions, then you could say, well, Hitler thought that for the greater good, the world needed to be a certain way. So he engaged with the conditions in the way that he thought was morally just. So, you know, when we say, oh, well, when it comes to how they treated Jews, it wasn't morally so good. Well, that's your judgment of it, but... he would argue.
Yeah, but then isn't that a good example of asymmetric, what did you call it?
Integration.
But then you're taking a relativist position that are you that I get stuck on this.
Well, the main point here is surely that he could say these things, but he could be largely wrong. You know, he could
So you're saying there is right and wrong?
That's the whole point, yes. Right. There is right and wrong, but what we are need to recognise is the limitations of our knowledge of this, but that doesn't stop us having making confident judgments about it.
Yeah.
You know? So I would quite confidently say, although Hitler did have his some redeeming features, largely he was wrong in the kind of judgments he made.
Does this go to, again to this idea of truth on the edge?
Yeah.
That it's not there isn't any right or wrong, that there's no absolute right or wrong.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Or, more precisely, there may be an absolute right or wrong, but we can't know it.
Yes.
Yeah. I suppose so.
So it's legitimate to say, I think I'm right about this, as long as it's qualified by I think. And I know that there's... It could be the case that this is right in some absolute way. But all I can say about it is that I've looked at the conditions and they suggest that this is the better thing to do in this situation.